UPN Friday on an all-new Star Trek Enterprise. The universe has an evil twin.
I'll shoot you myself.
I'll kill you when I get out of this.
Break him. Will you kindly die?
Parallel universe.
Where anything can happen. And probably will. With an exciting encounter in the world of classic Star Trek. The final five episodes.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge in 2020...
This is Tyler Orton watching his Gorn slave master get stuck on a gravity plate.
That old chestnut.
Yeah. I wrote that in all my Christmas cards over the holidays, Cam.
Now, why are we talking about Gorns being stuck on plates? Because we, this week, are going to talk about the Enterprise two-parter in a mirror, comma, darkly.
Yeah, Cam, this for me was probably one of my top Enterprise episodes, and I think what it comes down to is, like, it's maybe the first time that I witnessed, like, Star Trek getting fan service right, and, like, everything about this I should not like, you know, because it has nothing to do with, like, the characters that we've met before. Or does it, though? You know, because it's totally detached from the narrative that we've been following for four seasons on Star Trek Enterprise. And so it's one of those one-off, you know, we've talked about it before, off-the-beaten-path sort of episodes, you know. So It's like, how can I become invested in what's going on here? Why does it matter looking forward to the future? But we'll get into this. Like, so much of what this hinges on is what we know of this universe. And I'm talking about the Star Trek universe, not just this mirror universe. What we know of this universe as well as what we know of the characters and how they can have a lot of fun playing off of everything And actually make you invested in what ultimately unfolds going throughout this two-parter.
Right. Yeah, I'm really excited to take on this one. It's one of those two-parters that I don't know that as good as some of the two-parters are that we've covered in Enterprise, this feels like their classic one. I feel like when it all is said and done for Enterprise, this is the one people will remember.
Do you think it's just because they're putting the characters in, button-down characters, into situations that we've never seen them in before, and it just delivers so many memorable moments with these characters? I just think that when I think back about this, there's just so many things that, like, stick in my brain and I can just, like, reference, like, immediately.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also helps that, you know, you reference fan service. It does for Star Trek fan service what Trials and Tribulations did, where it feels like it's taking the idea of fan service. And, I mean, they're putting on original series uniforms in this episode for no real reason.
Exactly, yeah.
But we are on
board.
Did they
not have their own Enterprise uniforms underneath those EV suits that they
exactly.
were?
Yeah, exactly. I get that
That's why they have to wear decon gel, Cam. Yeah.
I get why Archer puts his on as, like, a joke. Next thing we know, the entire crew is changed over, and it's like, was this really necessary? Yeah. But it is so fan service-y, and yet it tells a great story and manages to string the elements together in a way that feels like an entirely new story being told.
Well, I think it's a difficult proposition for you to just drop within this universe, because there's no crossover within this, because every other mirror universe that we've seen...
You're talking about the DS9 episode, right?
Well, that's just it, though. But every other mirror universe episode that we'd seen prior to this, we have our Prime Universe characters crossing over into the mirror universe or vice versa. And so we kind of get a feel, you know, we have that...
We get like a fish out of water kind of scenario.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have, you know, kind of your designated, you know, character that you get to follow along. They drop all the exposition on you. They don't have that option here, or at least they chose not to go with that option. I think that's probably one of the most brilliant things about this entire, you know, two-parter that they did here. I remember
the first time I watched it and being kind of taken aback by that. I realized I was coming up on a Mirror Universe two-parter, but when I realized that it didn't have the Prime characters in it, I was really kind of like, wait, what? You expect me to watch two episodes in a row with characters I don't know.
So for like,
and how, it totally worked for me.
How long were you kind of waiting for maybe somebody to make an appearance? Were you just like kind of maybe after the first or second act, you were
probably
like,
like 15, 20 minutes in, I was like, yeah, okay, I guess I'm just going to do this.
Or, an hour, 15, 20 minutes in.
The credits are still rolling. I'm like, well, it's going to happen anytime now, guys.
There's going to be an end title sequence where.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where's Seth MacFarlane? But I mean,
that would have been the most amazing Ensign Rivers.
No, it's all a dream.
No. It's all Kelby's dream.
Yeah, Kelby like wakes up and is like, whew, what a dream. But yeah, like I remember really almost. Annoyed's the wrong word, but kind of being like, oh, like, I don't know about this. Like, just watching these characters who are disconnected from the larger universe of this show for 2 hours.
You're thrown out of your comfort zone, right?
Yeah,
and I think that's what good storytelling often does, though.
That's what that episode with Emery Erickson did.
Oh,
with the transporter.
Yeah. That threw me out of my comfort zone.
Babylon? Is that it?
No. Wasn't it not... Oh, shoot. Waxwing. Who am I thinking of? The Greek tale.
Oh, yeah.
Daedalus.
Daedalus. That's it. There. Yeah.
No, but, you know, I think they kick it off brilliantly by having one of the most iconic scenes up to that point in Star Trek with first contact between Vulcans and humans. And we have literally James Cromwell making his second appearance as Zefram Cochrane in the series.
Did he actually do this or was this reused footage?
This is all reused footage. And the interesting thing is that they had to go back and use the exact same film stock that they used for first contact for just the teaser, though. And they had actually switched over to digital video by season 4 just to cut down on costs.
It definitely has more of that grain look to it.
Yeah, so that was fascinating. So we get that sequence where instead of, you know, like giving a handshake to the Vulcan ambassador or the, you know, explorer, he pulls out a shotgun and starts blowing them all away and they rush the ship and you're like, oh, we are in for a different universe right now.
I love this intro. And of course, they're using the first contact music as well to really draw you into the scene. And you're
Jerry
like,
Goldsmith, man.
Yeah, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm having all the nostalgic feels right now over this moment. And just pull the rug out from under you. I think this is just, first off, an incredibly fun way to start a Star Trek episode. It's thinking outside the box and giving the viewer something they did not realize they ever wanted to see.
Just like Commander Riker in Schisms, where he falls asleep at the end of the teaser.
Well, sort of like that. That wasn't the one I was going to compare it to. But what I thought of actually while watching this now, I wouldn't have thought this one at the time, but it reminded me a lot of the Star Trek Discovery, last time on Star Trek Discovery, and showing footage of the cage.
Right.
Memory serves, which is another really playful, unexpected way to start an episode.
Yeah, you know, that might be maybe the closest experience that I've had there. But Star Trek, I think it's best when it's being playful, or it can sometimes reach heights unseen when it's being playful here. They're doing that in this sequence. And Cam, do you think this might be... an argument could be made that this might be the best teaser that we've seen in Star Trek.
Well, you already referenced the Riker yawning one.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like the most ambitious one I can think of off the top of my head.
Just to throw everybody into a different sort of expectation mode about what's going to unfold in the ensuing, you know, 90 minutes.
Like, you would have a lot... say in the original series, probably even in TNG, where like a surprise character walks onto the scene and everyone's like, what? Credits.
Well, just like in Deep Space Nine Defiant, and Riker strolls into, you know, Quark's bar and is flirting with Kira.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Like, that's a pretty common Star Trek go-to where you kind of have those characters kind of surprised, credits. And that's the hook for, you know, why the audience wants to keep watching. Who is this character? Or why is this character back? You know, that's a great hook. But this one is so wacky that I think it just grabs you in a way where you, like, realize you are seeing one that it's not following the playbook, which I think other great ones do. Like, there's lots of great Star Trek teasers that follow the playbook of how to tease the show that's to come. Whereas this one, you don't really know what you're in store for.
Let's say you're watching UPN back in the day.
As I was.
As you were. Yeah. Well, you had to get to your WWE Smash Night.
Can you smell what The Rock is cooking?
Yeah. And so this unfolds. What Star Trek fan is switching to another station after they see this? Like, you have to know what unfolds afterwards. And I think they kick it up one more notch when we get into the main title sequence, which is a completely different title sequence.
Yeah.
And it's all the military aspects of humanity. It's right. The conquest mode.
And the evolution of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, they're using like all the kind of stock footage just of like the Makos shooting people, which yeah. I thought was kind of funny, you know, from like the Zindi arc.
I love when it does the inspirational shot of the ship firing down on the planet.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Or just, you know, mankind planting a Terran Empire flag on the planet Moon.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's like cool stuff here. And so I just bask in the brilliance of all the exposition that they are dumping on viewers within the first like 3 minutes, just to get it all out of the way, so you understand what's going on here. And I'll give you another thing, like a kind of an analog that people are talking about a lot right now, though, is like Watchmen, the HBO series just wrapped up its first season. Don't know if it's coming back, but
made Barack Obama's list of the best television shows of the year.
Did you notice his own movie made his list of best movies of the year?
Well, I put our YouTube videos on my best films of the year. That's all it was just a list of our YouTube videos.
Other than that, I do say that Barack Obama, do you think it's actually him making his own list? I think it seems very curated, because I'm like, I'll say this man has very good taste in cinema if this is his list of movies of the year.
I mean, I thought that, but I also thought, boy, this man watches nothing but serious movies.
Fair enough.
I would seem to have a lot of fun.
Yeah. And, what do you think would be the comedy that he sat down and just like cackled to?
The Spy Who Cheated on Me. What was the one with Mila Kunis?
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. But it's like the Spy Who Loved. No,
it's not.
It?
That's the Bond movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I was saying Cheated on Me. I don't remember the name.
Something along those lines. Okay. She was just cackling there.
Yeah. I was just trying to think of the most like kind of tossed off 2-star comedy I could think of off the top of my head. Yeah. That one popped into my mind.
Speaking of Watchmen, though.
Yeah.
the brilliance, though, it's like a similar thing that they're doing in Enterprise, and Enterprise did it, you know, like 15 years earlier, though, is like they're just thrusting you into this universe, and then it's up for them to kind of like give you morsels as this story unfolds more and more throughout the course. In this case, 90 minutes. In the case of Watchmen, 9 episodes. And you don't feel frustrated. You don't feel like, well, I don't understand what's going on. I'm going to just throw my remote at the TV. No, you're like, well, maybe I don't understand exactly what's going on, but I'm going to continue to watch and find out more and more. And I think that's why this is such an addictive episode to watch. I mean, this might be the 5th or 6th time that I've seen this two-parter.
Yeah.
I never get sick of it, though.
Yeah, I really had to admire this time. And we're right now just going to talk really about part one. But I mean, like, I really had to admire how well this episode, this two-part story is really broken into chunks of these kind of adventures that really do carry you through. Like, there is a through line connecting them all. So it's like propulsive, and the characters are obviously doing a lot to carry you along too, but it is broken into these chunks of things happening that themselves are absorbing.
Yeah.
Like, it really is great. And I mean, you know, a lot of the conversation right now has been about, you know, Star Wars, the new Star Wars movie, The Rise of Skywalker. And like, you see a movie that's so convoluted and confused and whatever, and then you look at a story like this and just see how it's so cleanly done, and you go like, boy, now that is great storytelling.
But it's simple storytelling.
Yes.
And because what I think...
But it never feels like dumb. It doesn't feel childish.
But you know? It's like you understand the motivations of the characters.
Yep.
And the thing is, and when I watch cinema, when I watch television, what I care most about are what the characters' journeys are. And mm-hmm. when I was watching this, I'm very much invested in whether T'Pol can succeed.
Yeah.
And what exactly is going on with Archer, which is like... I think when we get into part two...
Archer's haircut is fascinating in this.
But when we get into part two and like... Yeah. What's unfolding in his mind?
Yeah.
It's some of the best Scott Bakula stuff that we've ever had.
Yeah.
What do you think of the idea of them like launching, I guess, you know, a mere Captain Forrest as our entry sort of character into universe?
Yeah. I really like that. I like that they are able to take, especially in like these mirror universe stories, and you know, obviously the DS9 ones do this as well, is take a peripheral character, not even like a ROM. I mean like one who's really kind of a smaller player, and give them
a Lark Voorhees, for example. Sure,
exactly. Yeah. A Lark Voorhees, but like, you know, take a character like that and just make them a more prominent role in a mirror universe story for fun. I mean, like Vedic Barile, for example, is actually a really good example. Or Jennifer Sisko.
How do you think they did with Vedic Barile from the mirror universe?
Wonderful.
Okay.
But you know, those are not characters you would necessarily see like headlining their own episodes, but you get to do that in the mirror universe. And,
I don't know, I thought life support as a headlining role for Vedic Barile was just fantastic.
That's right. But, you know, they get to do that here by taking Forrest, a character who's typically on the view screen talking to Archer. He does get some FaceTime with Archer.
Yeah.
I say FaceTime, but really that's what they're doing in every episode with Forrest. But actually, you know, sharing the same space.
FaceTime means something different now than it did back then.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, again, Forrest is a very limited role on the show. And to get to see Von Armstrong doing fun stuff and playing a commanding, you know, Mirror Universe captain is really cool.
Well, that's why they call him Von Armstrong.
That'd be amazing if that's how he referred to himself.
Yeah. But it's also cool because, like, this is a character or an actor whose role as Admiral Forrest, like, he died earlier on in the season.
Yeah.
So we're like, okay, like, let's be honest. Like, nobody expected to see a return of this character here.
No.
So you get to, like, transport a person who we're actually familiar with at this point. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of a brilliant thing for them to do. And it also gives you kind of that gateway into Archer's ascent in his efforts to subvert, because who else would have been kind of the character he would have been trying to push aside at this point here?
Right. Yeah. I mean, Enterprise doesn't have like a deep bench of supporting characters to draw from.
Especially not from Starfleet.
Yeah.
Our deep bench. You
could say that Shran was a member of Starfleet in this universe, but like, there's not a lot else to really choose from.
I am a little bummed that Shran never made an appearance in this two-parter, but I think, honestly, if we continued on into like season 5, we would have totally gotten Shran as part of probably the rebellion leader or something.
I would have to imagine that the reason he's probably not in this, unless they wanted to save money, because this does seem a little more expensive than their typical episode, would be possibly to save Jeffrey Combs for the next time they did this.
Do you think then that they could, it was a lost opportunity not to tap one Captain Hernandez, who we both really liked in her previous, I think she's in like 2 or 3 episodes throughout the season.
Yeah.
And in charge of the Columbia, you know, we both said she's a great character. That would have been a lot of fun for her to have a role, because we had a lot of these like nondescript, like Admiral Black sort of characters. And it's like, who?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I know. When they were introducing Admiral Black, I was like, is this a character that means something? And I don't think so.
I went into Memory Alpha. I was like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of a disappointment, because you didn't have to hire the same actor who played like Admiral, there's like a Commander Williams and an Admiral Leonard, or maybe.
So memorable.
I'm getting them mixed up, but you could have just, you know, done those names, and we would have at least recognized it as a shout out to Broken Bow when those characters were originally, you know, introduced just as shout outs to the original triumvirate from TOS.
Minor diversion, but related. Why do you think it is that Enterprise, in its 4 seasons, didn't build up a bigger bench of supporting characters like the other shows did?
It does kind of make sense in that. Well, okay, maybe we should compare show to show, because, you know, Enterprise is always on the move.
Yeah.
You know? And so if we think about their bench, it's, what, Saval, Forrest, and Shran.
And then you can say Erica Hernandez, who's...
But she's probably on, like, the next tier down, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I would say during the Zindi arc, they actually did build a very, very good bench.
Yeah, with, like, Degra and those, like, a bunch of the villains and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that the distinction, though, is it's, like, it's different when you're kind of following one arc or within one kind of confined area. It's easier to build that up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a few others that we can point out is T'Pol's mother, T'Pol's husband, Koss, as well.
Sure.
You know, like, so there's a little bit of that, but it all comes back to them kind of returning to the same spots where it seemed as if, you know, Enterprise was on the move again and again.
Right.
I wonder if the best, you know, kind of comparison would be, like, how deep is the bench on, say, Star Trek Voyager?
Sure.
You know?
I guess you've got, like, Vorik. I guess there's not a lot. It's just
Maj Kala.
Maj Kala, well, Seska.
Yeah.
But a lot of time they're leaving these characters behind as well. I guess maybe Voyager feels a little richer just because it has a much bigger cast, or it's, you know, a few extra main cast members as well.
So
you could have also, you know, if you did, say, Mirror Universe in late season Voyager, you maybe would have brought Kes back as well. Like, there are other characters you could bring in.
All things being equal, if they could have brought Kes back for, like, a Mirror Universe episode, that would have been a lot of fun. I think
Fury might have made sense if it was a Mirror Universe episode.
Yeah. I'll take that.
Yeah.
What if the Vidians were, like, not you know, sickly.
They were like models, like supermodels.
See, they could have had so much fun with like a Voyager Mirror Universe episode, you know? Yeah. I just don't think they would have ever done that. I think their argument is like, well, we kind of did that with Living Witness, you know?
Sure.
Which I totally buy, you know? Yeah. That's the closest equivalent that we got. And so I do wonder, when we're talking about a bench, though, do you think that they essentially kind of wiped their bench clean on Star Trek Discovery, knowing what we know going into season 3?
It would seem so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even think we're going to get some reappearances of Spock number one or Pike, you know, I mean, I'm sure maybe, I don't know, they could appear in a flashback, but that's not really the same thing as like continuing adventures with these characters. Like we got to some degree with, like we're talking about Tran, Saval, and Forrest.
Yeah. No, Discovery really has done that, like kind of wiped out its supporting cast, a big number of them.
So if we go back to In a Mirror Darkly, though, here's the teeter-totter effect or the seesaw effect that I'm following with this narrative, which I find absolutely brilliant, is like, I don't know who I'm cheering for any given scene. It's do I want to see, you know, one Commander Archer at this point do a mutiny against Forrest, who actually seems for a Mirror Universe guy to be pretty okay.
Forrest, reasonable in both worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
He is the best of both worlds.
And then we also have, like, let's be honest, Linda Park was never given anything better to do than in this Mirror Universe two-parter.
Yeah,
and
she's great.
I say that despite the fact that a lot of this, like the sexual politics in this is kind of problematic, and you can tell it's kind of written by dudes in like the mid-aughts. Like, I don't think they would do the same thing in this universe where it's essentially her using like sexuality to get ahead. And I'm not saying that anybody should be shamed for doing that, but what it is, you know, kind of buying into stereotypes about like women just using their bodies to get ahead,
right?
And, like, it's like some icky sort of stuff. But all that aside,
but what makes it, I think, work though ultimately, and why we can still watch this episode and not feel gross like the way we do about some, say, I don't know, TNG Troy episodes or something, mm-hmm. is that she's the one who's very much playing chess and very much the winner at the end. And I think by intention, I think she's the one with the master plan.
Yeah, it doesn't seem as if she's just kind of being tossed aside all the time. It's
not like circumstance that makes her wind up, I think, on top at the end.
Cam, is she the Palpatine of this entire universe where she's been pulling the strings this entire time?
I guess so.
Okay.
She's better than Palpatine at this point.
Okay. She doesn't have like a Borg Queen hook that carries her around different rooms.
By her head?
Yeah.
That would have been the follow-up episode.
Yeah, so like eventually, like we are introduced to other characters like slowly but surely, and I think that's kind of the key thing, is like they're not overloading us with like introductions to different Mirror Universe characters that we're familiar with.
Yeah, and
the
like Saval doesn't show up until episode 2, which is really smart.
When you were watching this, did you like forget that Saval does not show up until episode 2?
Yes, I kept thinking like, where's Saval? Like I recall him playing a very prominent role, but I don't know that I'd ever noticed, and I referenced this before, like how it really is broken into these chunks. And I don't think I'd realized that in the previous times I watched this episode until I'm really sitting here this time taking notes and tracking it kind of moment to moment, going like, oh, okay, they have their like kind of little like side missions in each of these episodes.
Well, and by chunks, I think we can note that there's the mutiny against Forrest.
Yep.
So it's that Archer can pursue this mission that he's created to go find this ship from the future.
Yeah.
Which I think if we're talking about fan service and we're talking about how you have to know that the writers, it was Mike Sussman who did part one, and then Manny Coto and Mike Sussman wrote part two.
Yeah.
You have to know that everybody in the writer's room must love what the Star Trek universe is when they're introducing the Constitution class Defiant from the Tholian Web as the ship that Archer is searching for. And I think we've talked about it in Mirror Darkly before, but I think you had pointed out kind of the brilliance before of them. Like, we never really knew what happened to the Defiant here. And I think that's them. It's almost their Rogue One sort of episode in which, like, they're kind of filling in a plot hole.
Sure.
Or not necessarily not a plot hole, but
just like I love that
unanswered question.
Right. I love that type of world building where something like that can happen. And you can pay it off later. It's not like it demanded to be answered, but it's open-ended. You know, like, I love that type of world building. It's something that I love that Star Wars does. One of my favorite examples from recent years is actually in Mad Max Fury Road, where they're driving through the wastelands, and there's those dudes dressed as crows, like, walking around, and they're just, like, looking at them. You could do a whole movie that delved into who those guys are. You don't have to.
Well, nobody understood my Halloween costume when I
that wasn't a Halloween costume. That was what you were doing on Christmas.
Yeah. My family was like, dude, stop it.
Yeah, but like, I love that type of world building. And that's what the original series especially really did well, would be introduce elements. You didn't need to follow up on them, but there was a mystery there that if you wanted to pay it off, you could. And I think they used it really smartly here as like a setup for your, especially part two.
And so within this, as we make our way into the Tholian territory, we have yet another mutiny where Forrest manages to retake the ship once again, and then kind of makes Archer continue on this mission because, I don't know, the ship's course can't be corrected or what have you. And but I like the idea of the Terran Empire being so bent on conquest that the idea of them pursuing kind of a ship or some sort of technology that can offer them even more conquest in the future, I think that, like, you understand the motivation of the characters involved here.
Yeah, well, like, the morality of the Mirror Universe is fairly simple to understand. You kind of get that pretty much everyone kind of wants the same thing to a certain degree, so it's not hard to drop you in the story. You don't need to, like, you know, really point the viewers in a certain direction, like, every 5 minutes, because they kind of understand how this universe works.
Yeah. And speaking of that, the other thing that's interesting, though, is kind of the introductions of, say, Mayweather and Reed.
This. Like, we see, Reed is so much fun in this.
Like, him, like telling Forrest, like, I hope no accident happens to you on the way to the brig. And then Archer, like, giving him a real beatdown.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that sort of fun stuff that I think, like, was Chekhov not kind of the character who was, like, flashing daggers in Mirror Mirror and, like, trying to, like, incite mutiny back then? So it's kind of interesting to see kind of the Reed-Chekhov, you know, I guess, parallels going on.
I like that he's just like this total psychopath. Archer's having to constantly keep in check.
Well, and then you can actually Forrest as well. Understand why Mayweather is maybe the one that he goes to and says, hey, I want you to be my personal guard.
Yeah.
And he's even saying funny stuff like, you'll get better food.
Right.
It's like, so you can understand, again, how this universe works. It's like people are enticed by the prospect of loyalty, and it'll deliver them tangible goods, whether it's like better grub or better quarters. And that's what Mayweather gets. And it is interesting to see that by the end of this two-parter, Mayweather is not an inactive character, though.
No.
Like, he's not passive. So that's fascinating as well.
Mayweather reminds me almost like a Bond villain henchman, where he's incredibly striking visual, like with the earring and like the way his hair's cut.
He's got
everything.
The widow's peak.
Yeah, like he looks incredibly tough. He doesn't have a lot of dialogue in this two-parter, but he's this incredibly strong.
Well, they didn't want to change things too much, you know. Like, Mirror Universe, that's one thing, but like giving Mayweather dialogue in an episode,
But he's an incredibly like strong-looking physical presence there.
Yeah.
And you buy him as someone with like a certain amount of authority and a certain amount of fearsomeness. So that even though he doesn't speak, he actually speaks a lot through his just physicality, which is not the case for that character, for Mayweather, usually.
Well, I think we know that the previous episode to this one was Bound, so he had been lifting weights in the gym right before. So.
He was speaking things we didn't really want to hear.
No. And then, of course, I think very importantly here, because it takes a while for us to figure out who the character is that I think we should ultimately be cheering for, but they do have the introduction of T'Pol.
Yeah.
But we're not necessarily meant to know where exactly she's going here.
Yeah.
She's very reluctant to take orders from Archer,
yeah.
you know, but I think he makes it clear to us, the audience, that he needs her expertise and her knowledge to continue on, and that's why he's not going to just throw her off into the brig.
Right. I think there is something that really does cue the audience in, though, that she's the most sympathetic character, just the way she reacts to Archer walking onto the bridge. Like, you don't get sort of that kind of cackling evil vibe off of her.
So what do you think it is then with regards to the Vulcans in the Prime Universe versus the Mirror Universe? Like, I had this thought here, and I'll pitch it to you. With regards to the Mirror Universe, I think it's really just a universe in which the humans are not good.
Right.
All the other aliens that we seem to encounter, they seem to have their own traits that we're familiar with in the Prime Universe. So I think that Vulcans in this universe are still innately logical and honorable.
And to see them oppressed, they are very much aware of their circumstances and have the recognition that maybe they can't get out of it.
Yeah.
Like, they can't delude themselves the way that maybe a human character could.
Well, even think about, like, I guess Phlox's arc throughout this. And by the, like, he's totally going full Mengali on us in, like, part one.
Yeah.
But
even a little bit part two.
Yeah, that's true.
But that, like, poor Tholian. That poor, poor Tholian.
but it is interesting to see that the Vulcans have been, I think, the most consistently portrayed as a species throughout all the Mira episodes that we've seen across Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's that line where they mention the Vulcan, the incident off the top of the episode with Cochrane meeting the Vulcans, and they refer to them as an invasion force. Do you think that was the case, or do you think that's a lie?
Oh, I think that's just propaganda. Yeah. Like, I have no doubt that they were just kind of the regular Vulcans. Like, and it, because I just think about, like, that main title sequence, and we're just, we know that humans are just bad to the bone in this particular universe.
Bad to the bone. Yeah, because it doesn't, like, I like the sense that, like, the Vulcans are, because they're logical, it would never make sense for them to adapt the attitudes of, like, Archer and crew.
Yeah.
Like, they are very much the outsiders here. And I think that's why this information from the Prime Universe appeals to them so much.
Yeah.
So, and Mirror Universe Spock, while he was serving with Barbarian Kirk, he was able to be turned. Like, when they actually, you know, had a logical conversation with him, he would be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's a really great idea. I should pursue this.
So it should maybe be no surprise that consistently it's kind of the Vulcans are the ones within the rebellion. You know, we even saw Tuvok in the Mirror Universe on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. He's part of the rebellion movement. We saw that with one Sarek in Star Trek Discovery too, you know. So
they're kind of the pivot points for the evolution of where the Mirror Universe goes.
So I am curious, you know, if we ever get a Mirror Universe adventure, you know, in the 25th century, the Terrans had a victory on Deep Space Nine, you know, I wonder if that's a turning point for the Terrans, if they revert back to their old ways, or I just, what I'm getting at though is, like, I'm curious about where the Vulcans are by that point.
Right. I think Mirror Universe is tough the further you push it, almost, because it's like, it's always supposed to be kind of like pirate land, and you're just going to have this shifting of power back and forth because you always want to have this ongoing conflict. I'm very curious whether you could evolve it into something that was recognizable to the Prime Universe without losing all the kind of the mystique and fun of what the Mirror Universe is.
I think maybe the best thing is, like, if you want to do a post NX-01 era, you know, I think by the time we got to the end of the Deep Space Nine Mirror Universe arc, it just kind of seemed spent for the 24th century.
Yes, it did.
And I'll say very much the same with regards to Discovery, you know, like I felt no ill will for the fact that we didn't return to the Mirror Universe in season two of Discovery. Like, by the time we left that universe, I was just, the first two episodes were pretty good.
Yeah.
The last two, not so much.
I kind of feel about the Mirror Universe the same way I do about Tribble episodes. You know, pick your shots, pull them off as good as you can, and walk away.
Yeah.
You know, kind of do the one for your show and walk away.
Okay. So, hey, look, just zoom to the conclusion, the climax of part one. We have the discovery of the Defiant, Archer and team. They head on over, and the Tholians attack the Enterprise with one Forrest in charge. He sacrifices himself for Hoshi.
Yeah.
That woman, you know, gotta hand it to her. Although, like, it still did, like, make my skin crawl when, like, there's a lot of that talk with her and Archer, and it's all the, like, yes, captains do get the possessions of the former captains following, like, a mutiny. I'm just like, okay, this is not, like, you know for a fact that Discovery writers would be writing around that sort of stuff. They just...
They did. They did when they went to the Mirror Universe themselves.
Well, even think about, like, kind of the uniforms, though. Yeah. Like, they made it purposeful. There's no kind of women, like, being
forced to
wear...
It's not like the midriff outfits.
Yeah, which, let's be honest, I felt bad for the actresses. Like, Linda Park looks like a leaf already, but there's moments where I could see her, like trying to, like, suck in her guts.
That is...
She has no gut.
That is brutal wardrobe to have to wear on television.
Cam, could you imagine if we had to, like, walk around like that?
Well, I am right now.
Well, I know. I am imagining.
Check out this week's YouTube video.
So, you know, like that, I just feel so bad for like, the woman that... Like, T'Pol and Hoshi were getting so many great things to do in this, but they were just kind of, like, saddled with, like, this just... like, horrible wardrobe requirements. Like, especially, like, the low-cut pants that T'Pol had to wear.
Yeah.
I like. Could you imagine if you had to wear
those? I am wearing them right now, Tyler. Okay. Check out this week's YouTube video.
Yeah. So I mean, that's sort like I don't want us to be like, oh, we love everything about this episode. There's definitely stuff to criticize here.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And I mean, Star Trek was still at this point trying to be sexy. I mean, this is the UPN era, but I mean, we had Bound just before this. Star Trek is trying to be sexy.
Cam, do you think a Mirror Universe decon jail sequence would be like TVMA? Like, I don't think it would be allowed on broadcast
television. Or is it like incredibly like sexless?
Because it's the Mirror Universe.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite. So like, if it's kind of intended to be sexy in the prime, is it just like very clinical and boring?
Cam, I don't think that's what Brandon Braga and Rick Berman had in mind whatsoever.
Well, no, probably not.
Yeah. So look, we pick up part two. We have the crew taking over the Defiance, making an escape, getting some escape pods. And again, Cam, you mentioned before, we have them switching over to the TOS era uniforms.
Yeah.
How fun is that just to see the old sets once again?
Yeah. I mean, I love seeing the old sets. I'm always curious how many times they built them over the years. But
Let's kind of think about, like, so we've seen Relics with Scotty and Picard, that great scene.
They only built a small section of it for that, right?
Yeah. And I think it's just a section for this episode as well.
Right.
So so Relics, and then we also got it with the Trials and Tribulations.
Yep.
So, and then we also got it with Itamir Darkly.
Yeah.
So, and then I guess we kind of got it with Enterprise as well, with like their rebooted version, like the visual rebooted version as well. So, and then I guess the Man Trap was the first time viewers ever got to see it. So it's been like that quintessential Constitution class bridge.
Yeah.
It's been introduced to viewers like five times. And I think you can tell that the creators always want to hold it with a certain amount of reverence. Like,
oh yeah,
when we walked onto the bridge in this two-parter, you kind of felt like the gravity, the heft of it, even though it was so fun to be on.
Oh yeah. I mean, every time I see it on an outside series of original series, like when they do it on Next Generation or Enterprise, it's just like they always depict it with a certain amount of awe. And you can really tell they're just like, it all came from this. Like, we are recognizing in this moment we would not be here without this bridge.
Yeah.
And it just looks so beautiful.
So, look, we keep getting into, I guess, more of the deep universe sort of, like, storylines that are going here. With, like, there's even more rebellion stuff that we didn't really realize how bad things were going for the Terran Empire. And I do like that they did introduce, like, a sense of scale where they said that there's, and this is in part one, but they said there was an attack and it was a devastating attack. They lost 12 ships.
Right.
Whereas we watch Star Trek Discovery and we get, like, you know, news bombs like, oh, yeah, we have a fleet of about, like, 40,000 ships. And so, like, it kind of takes away, like, if you hear the destruction of, like, one or two ships, you know, like, how many souls were lost at the Battle of the Binary Stars? I think about 10,000 people, right?
Right.
So it just, and I'm not saying, like, you know, it doesn't matter that, you know, a few people lost their lives, but it does diminish the scale of it. I think it's brilliant for them to say, like, yeah, we have kind of like this rudimentary Starfleet.
Mm-hmm.
It was a devastating loss. It was 12 ships. You feel, so that means that you feel the destruction of one ship that much more, which we get with, say, the Enterprise. And then later on, we have the introduction of the Avenger, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Like, I feel like, you know, this two-parter really does a good job at establishing stakes without, you know, it doesn't really need constant space battles or anything, but you do feel the sort of the epic scope of this story in a way that is affordable for TV.
Oh, was this affordable? Because I look at the production values here, and I'm like, how, because like, the thing is, I think Enterprise knew that, you know, it was going to be canceled.
Mm-hmm.
Were they saving up all the budget, or were they just pouring their hearts and souls and, you know, just doing everything they could to make every dollar go that much further throughout this?
I mean, I guess they get two episodes worth out of their investment. I don't know.
Yeah.
It does seem to me like it. Enterprise is a show I can never really figure out how expensive it was, because it does seem like a lot of what they do does look more expensive than what, say, TNG was doing.
I think they had a, like, if you do inflation and everything, I still think they had a, like, a sizably bigger budget to work with. And I also think the dollars went further just with how much more VFX came down in cost as well.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I don't think they'd be throwing things like the Gorn in if they didn't have money to throw around.
Well, we differ on kind of the depiction of the Gorn here.
Slar.
I like the idea. You know, he is talking into a communicator. You can, think about it that maybe that's just how the Universal Translator translates his voice. I thought it was great that he was doing a very kind of pompous sort of voice. That made me laugh. And also, I'm looking at this like 15-year-old episode.
Yeah.
Slar looks pretty good for like a Gorn.
It actually did look better than my memory was. Like when I watched it, and I watched it on the Blu-rays, it actually looked pretty good.
Yeah.
I do love that shot. The first time we're really seeing something through Slar's eyes where he's doing the dive down the hole at the guy. And it's so the Alien 3 shot.
Well, Cam, do you remember who he kills?
Yeah, was it Kelby?
It was Kelby. Yeah. Like, I love how they bring back Kelby.
Yeah.
You know, again, because the previous time that we saw Kelby, it was in Bound, and he was once again just being a total turd.
Right.
And so once again, they're like, yeah, let's bring back Kelby just to, like, kill him off.
But they play him, like, very innocent.
Yeah. I don't know why we find Kelby so fascinating, but it's just, like, one of those kind of useless characters that they kind of keep bringing back just to torture, which is, like, sort of fun.
Yeah. I mean, Star Trek does have a pretty good history of kind of doofy characters that we like to make fun of.
We don't have kind of the... Well, I guess Milton Richter is the closest that we have from Star Trek Discovery.
But he's only in, like, the first chunk of season one.
He's not in the first two episodes, so we're introduced to him in episode 3, and I think he was gone by episode 7, so I think...
Yeah.
What is it? We just like his name?
I guess so.
Yeah, there's no doofy
character. I think it was just the fact he was so bland that that's what made him memorable.
He was very much like... Every time I watch, like, old episodes of Star Trek, I'm like... They were really going to the Melrose Place reject casting like hall for a lot of these roles. I'm just like, it's generic 90s guy all the time. I'm just like, wow, with Milton Richter, they once again wanted to go with generic 90s guy.
And I like how we can often never tell them apart. Like, just over the holidays, I came to the shocking realization that the guy who played Shakar also played Ronan the Sex Candle in Sub Rosa. And I was blown away that I'd never realized that.
I had no idea either until you had messaged me.
It's just because so many of those actors look kind of similar.
Well, and Cam, if he comes to one of the Star Trek conventions, like, we need to buy a green candle... And get our photo taken with him at this point.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And our Bajoran earrings as well.
Yes, obviously.
Yeah. So, look, we're continuing on with this adventure. I think we're getting into more diversion mode with the whole Slar thing, which I'm fine with.
It's fun. Like, it's a really cool, I think, setup when we find out it's a Gorn. That's the first thing we find out. We don't see Slar at that point. And so you have these characters hunting Slar. We know it's a Gorn, but we also don't know what it's going to look like because, again, it's a 2005 show, so how are they going to do it? And it's the build-up to the reveal, and I think that's a lot of the fun. Well, we're not just, like, hunting the Gorn. We're getting to see what it, we're waiting to find out what it looks like through the characters.
Next time we see a Gorn, though, it's a skeleton in Lorca's ready room.
Yeah.
Or no, it was his man cave, I should say. Do you think we'll see Gorn in Season 3 of Discovery?
Now it's possible, I think. I think in the past, they were always kind of like, well, we don't really know how to make this work.
Yeah.
I think now just, they could.
Timeline-wise, because First Contact was actually in the original series. Yeah. So
they always could have in Deep Space Nine or TNG. They just never chose to
Do
go
think
there.
They just worried it was going to look super hokey.
Yeah. I don't think they could have done it very well. Like, look at the creature in like the Dauphin.
Yeah, no.
You know, like, I don't want to see the Gorn look like that, thanks.
But I think after watching Discovery first two seasons, we're convinced if they go with practical, it'll look pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about the prospect of seeing a Gorn in Star Trek Discovery Season 3. And I think
Discovery would do it.
Yeah.
I think so. Like, they've definitely not been afraid to work in elements of popular Star Trek canon. Like, they'll throw Andorians out there. They'll throw Tellarites in there. I could see them... They've done Tribbles already, a couple times. I could see them saying, let's put a Gorn in there. Yeah. I don't see why not.
So just for a dramatic tension sort of dealio with regards to the writers, they introduce the idea of Archer finding the database and looking up people's lives in this other...
Yeah.
In the Prime universe. Yeah. And everyone was made very uncomfortable with the whole prospect of this. And this is actually touched on again in Star Trek Discovery, where they really want to classify this entire idea of an idealistic Prime universe where there's a Federation, not an empire, and it's all about embracing each other. But this is where Archer gets really disgusted with the idea of, you know, humans not dominating other species, yeah, but working together with other species.
Would you be horrified if you found out about an alternate universe version of yourself?
And he was
had
really
the file there?
And he was really good? And he's a nice human being? Yeah, you bet I would.
Because I like how she's like, I don't want to know. I don't want to know anything. I'd be like, yeah, let me read up. It's not me.
I don't know. Like, I can understand why it would feel like off-putting, though.
Okay.
You know, because you know, in the back of your head, you're like, well, it could be something that I choose to do. Or
right.
I could find myself, if there are so many other parallels between universes, I just wonder if I am, you know how, whenever we see all these efforts in movies and TV for people, you know, they get a prophecy. Mm-hmm. And so their mission is to try to make the prophecy not happen. And
right.
in that, they just kind of fulfill the prophecy.
Right.
I would worry that that's what I'm doing in my day-to-day life. That's why I kind of want to just stay away from it. Like, I get the curiosity factor, though.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I feel like I would be able to differentiate between the two and be like, well, this is an entirely different individual. I am not the same person.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'd be all about reading that info. Well, although it drove Archer crazy, well, so maybe I'd be crazy.
That's just it, because now we get, like, the story element of Prime Universe looking Archer in like his regular uniform and regular haircut, just
like his hair's not dyed black like he's Trent Reznor,
but he's just like totally like crawling all over Archer, planting like seeds of doubt in his brain. Scott Bakula's performance, it's like we've never seen him chew the scenery so much in any episode of Star Trek, and
no.
It was so much fun to watch.
It's really, really fun. And I mean, I wonder if maybe from a storytelling point of view, it's a little too quick to have Mirror Universe Archer going kind of loco this quickly.
I know what you're saying.
But, you know, I'm willing to forgive it because there's a lot to condense into this two-episode story. It totally works in terms of the character where he goes. But I think you could have done it maybe with, like, the seeds kind of starting maybe in... I don't know if you could have done it in part one, but to just kind of build it up a little more. But it still works.
I would definitely say in part one, this is a man that I can believe is being a little bit unbalanced.
Yeah.
So, but him, I wonder if, like, we weren't explicitly told what the trigger was for this descent into mental illness, other than the fact that he had looked into this database.
Right.
You know, I wonder if they could have been a little bit more explicit there.
Yeah. Well, he got thrown in, like, the agony booth, right?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, for like 10 hours or something. So maybe...
That was still in part one.
That's in part one, yeah. But maybe they could have established like...
Maybe that was a trigger?
It had done something
okay.
to him.
Okay, yeah. I could have totally bought
that's
that.
A quick way to write it out where you go, okay, I get it. He's already not in the best of mind because of this, so that might work.
So the rest of the episode essentially follows a mission to get the Defiant back to Earth. We have Archer saying like to Admiral Black, well, this is going to be my ship now. You know, you don't have to, like, look around for a ship for me. This is mine. Admiral Black's like, wait, what?
I don't think Archer's that bright.
Well, Archer knows he has a trump card, though.
Yeah.
What is the rest of Starfleet going to do at this point? Like, try to take it away? Like, how are they going to do that? Like, this ship can overpower them, outspeed them,
mm-hmm.
you know, anything like that. But you do touch on something, Cam. Archer does not seem like a very smart man in this universe
at
all.
No, he does not.
Like, in terms of, like... long-term thinking.
Yeah.
He's definitely not the Hoshisato of this universe.
Definitely not. No. Not even the forest.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, he's probably brighter than Reed. This is actually one of my favorite lines in, like, this second part, where Reed's been badly injured in the Gorn incident or whatever. And we have, like, Phlox be like, yeah, you might make it. Might not. And that's, like, the end of that character this episode.
Yeah, one of my the weirdest Phlox moments, though, was when we go to sickbay, and there's, like, this animal that's just totally splayed out guts, like, sticking out. I was just like, wow, it's 8 p.m. television for you back in the day, guys.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So, ultimately, I mean, we have a lot of, like, hoodwinking going on, but it's revealed that essentially, like, Hoshi and with the help of Mayweather,
mm-hmm.
they've kind of, like, gotten rid of Archer after all this kind of rebellion sort of stuff is kind of put down. But we are, you know what, I want to go back to the scene between T'Pol and Saval, where she's saying, like, you're always kind of known as the... idealistic sort of visionary, and he's like, I'm getting too old for this.
Right.
And she's like, what is the future going to be? Because I've spoken to Archer. You've heard him give this big speech in the cargo bay. You know that all he really wants to do is eradicate non-Terrans. So what does that mean for your legacy and the future of the Vulcan race? And I think that's that might be one of my favorite scenes between like any characters, because it's it seems as if they're the two like good characters right. in this entire story. And of course, you know, Saval's got that really awesome glued on goatee that he's rocking there.
Oh, of course,
there
yeah. And you got to give him Vulcan the goatee. It always yeah. works in the Mirror
Remember
Universe.
How, like, dumb we felt when we were debating which character would get a goatee in the Mirror Universe in Star Trek Discovery, and then the next episode, it was Sarek that appeared with the goatee, and we were like, oh, we should have guessed
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I know. We were not bright. But, no, I did really enjoy the T'Pol Saval stuff. Again, we have this whole rebellion. We've also got Hoshi and everything she's got going on. And all of this is incredibly clear.
Yes.
It's not at all confusing. We have multiple plots going on, and it all like plays out so smoothly. It's really great writing.
Yeah. The one thing that I that threw me off a little bit was, remember when T'Pol and Saval are trying to convince Phlox to turn against the captain?
Yeah.
And they're making the case, well, you know, like if you help protect the current emperor against Archer's attempts to become emperor, you'll get a whole lab to yourself and with all the concubines you can wish for. And then right. Saval's eyebrows start wiggling uncontrollably.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, it's not necessarily the Vulcans that we know in either universe. Right. What is Saval doing in that moment? I think it's just Gary Graham having a lot of fun with his imagination at that point.
He thought he was off camera.
Yeah. He's like, this is just dress rehearsal, right, guys? Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so ultimately, like, we get to the Hoshi reveal, which, Cam...
One of the great scenes in Enterprise.
Do you want to tell the story that's how we celebrated that reveal when we were at a Star Trek convention back, I think, in 2017 at the All Trek Mind, right? One Trek Mind, yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, at One Trek Mind, it's a panel that Jordan Hoffman puts on every year at the Las Vegas Con. He often does multiple, and... it's all about fans voting for lists, like top 10 lists of, say, like, there was, I think, best Star Trek animals was on either this past year or the year before.
Pets.
Yeah, pets.
Yeah.
Way
too many people like Spot. And I was just
Or there was one on, like, Klingons, for example. But one year, there was one for Mirror Universe characters. And it was a real battle between, I think, was it the Intendant and Hoshi?
Yeah.
I think for the winner. And we, like, started, like, a cheer for, like, Hoshi, Hoshi.
It was you, me, and a good friend of the podcast, Scott Hardy. We were just yelling our heads off. And then we got other people around us to start chanting as well. And Jordan Hoffman, the facilitator of all this, he just had this incredibly exasperated look on his face as if he had lost control of this entire thing.
Yeah.
Alas, I do recall Empress Hoshi did not get the title of the best Mirror Universe character.
I think that makes sense. I mean, Kira does make a lot of sense.
Kira makes sense. Amir Spock makes sense, too. But I think Empress Hoshi had a good run.
Oh,
and
definitely.
It just tells you, like, how many, like, you know, badass things, like, Linda Park got to do throughout this episode. Although,
I think she has a really good shot at number one if we get more seasons of Enterprise and we get more of her in Mirror Universe episodes.
Well, and that's such a bummer to me because, like, Manny Coto, the showrunner of season four, he said that his intention was, you know, every subsequent season we would just drop in once a year on the Mirror Universe and then just see what's unfolding. And it would have been, like, awesome to see what exactly happened to, like, Archer at this point.
Yeah, because they left it open-ended. Like, Archer and Reed are both left open-ended, so we don't really know what happened with them.
But we see that Mayweather is on the ascent with Hoshi as well.
Yep.
We have this rebellion going on that, look, I mean, maybe they destroyed some ships, but I think there's still the opportunity, and we know that rebellion is continuing on in the Star Trek Discovery era, too. So it just would have been so much fun to continue popping in. And we even said, hey, other characters could have popped in, like Hernandez or Shran. Like,
I have to feel those two would have shown up in the next one, right?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. So,
yeah.
I don't. So the one thing that bugs me most is, like, there seemed to be all that more potential for them to have even more fun with this. But it didn't seem as if they were, like, leaving anything, you know, to mine later on. They wanted to go all out with this, which is, I think, really kind of the right idea.
Yeah, I think it was a great idea just to go all in, do all the fun stuff they could really think up in this two-parter, get it all out there. and kind of just walk away and be like, you know, if you don't get a second one, it's all held together in a really great 2-hour story. You don't need to say any more. I think fans are always going to want more out of this two-parter, yeah. But, you know, we got what we got. And ultimately, it's kind of a perfect two-parter. And you look at, say, the DS9 Mirror Universe stories, they're kind of diminishing returns at a certain point. Discovery, I felt the same way.
By the time we're following the Ferengi universe, like, to steal cloaking devices, it's just kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
They don't feel special by then.
Right, and yeah. I think Mirror Universe stories should be events. Yeah. And that's something, yeah, Discovery, by the time you got to part 4 of that, I was like, I'm done.
Yeah, so ultimately, for me, I might have to place this as number one all-time favorite Enterprise episodes, which it contradicts the way that I usually tackle television. And, like, my favorites are the ones that there's build-up with the characters that we've been following for a long time, and this is paying it off. This is just such a great one-off episodic adventure that I just cannot deny how much fun this was to watch.
We did our episode on best Voyager episodes some time ago. It would be really interesting, I think, to do a best Enterprise episodes, because I think, again, that's another one that, like, there would be a lot of debate as to exactly what are the best Enterprise episodes. Again, TNG is kind of boring to do, but
it's Enterprise, all the same episodes that everyone's been discussing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, oh, best of both worlds and Tapestry? I'm shocked, you know. But if you do Enterprise, I think there's a lot of room for debate.
And, you know, just for listeners, we will be tackling the conclusion of Enterprise, hopefully right before Picard hits the air. And we're going to do it in a different way, because I know that These Are the Voyages are maybe not the most revered episode, but there is yet another two-parter kind of connected to the conclusion. So I think that'll be fun to tackle a little bit later on this month.
Yeah. But I love that also this episode ends with, like, an iconic image of Hoshi, like, looking kind of out at the audience in a way on the bridge, which, you know, a lot of Enterprise doesn't have iconic visual moments. And I think this is one of them.
There's some stuff in, like, E2 that I liked.
Yep.
Or E2, whatever you want to call it.
Archer outrunning fire is one.
Yeah.
There are moments here and there. It's just not... There's not a lot of them.
You like it whenever a CG Sulaban falls out of a ship.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. Cam, before we wrap up, we alluded to this. So we did not get to kind of, you know, finish up the Mandalorian report before that series concluded its inaugural run there. I think when we did leave it off, was it the prison episode? Or was it right before?
No, we did the penultimate one. We did do the penultimate episode.
Okay.
We did two of them back to back. And then, we just haven't done the finale.
Oh, yeah, finale. Like, I think I left it off with saying the penultimate episode. Like, it was not a finale a penultimate episode I thought was, like, super strong, because it left too much dangling in what had previously been a very episodic series.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that they could do that much interesting by eliminating who had been the big antagonist that unceremoniously, and then introducing a brand new one as if we're supposed to care.
Right.
I don't know. This series continues to surprise me, like, week in, week out, which is, like, what you should be doing as a TV show. So, I thought the conclusion to the Mandalorian, the season one finale, was one of my favorite episodes of the season.
Mm-hmm.
There's just some very awesome visuals. You get that there is emotional resonance for the characters going on here, and you're invested in what's going on ultimately with these characters.
And some really fun stuff. Like, right off the top, those biker scouts just talking back and forth about, you know, what's in the bag.
I was watching it with my friend, and she was just horrified when they're punching the bag.
Right.
Like, absolutely horrified by this.
And helping to explain why the scout troopers can't shoot anything.
That was pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, but you know, okay, that moment, like, might stick out to me most, because it's an extended, what, like, 4 or 5 minute sequence, and all it is are people talking, and it's somebody wants one thing, somebody else wants another thing, and that's exactly what drama is, the people that want two conflicting things, and then how does that ultimately get resolved? And I think it was just really, like, that's good dramatic writing. I think too many times we forget that. And we just have kind of plot point going on, and you don't really think about what the characters' motivations are.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the threat to me felt genuinely interesting with, you know, Giancarlo Esposito's character. I didn't know a lot about him. We still don't. It's obviously going to carry into the next season. But he was, for someone who's brought in so late in the game, I thought he had a really strong presence. And I was genuinely interested into where this character might go.
I'm like, just watching it, I get the sense that like he's essentially kind of like a bureaucrat that found himself in some very, very fortunate circumstances that allows him to amass like a lot of power.
Yeah.
And like that's kind of not a villain that we've really seen so much before in yeah. Star Wars. And I'd be interested in them exploring this guy who is way above his station and just doing stuff that maybe he's not totally 100% well-equipped to do.
Right.
Like, I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, and he appears to have a Darksaber at the end, which I'm very curious because that's an element of like extended universe type stuff. But they have been quite diligent about working in elements of the expanded universe into the actual canon of Star Wars over the last while through their animated series, as well as like Rogue One did a bunch of stuff. And it looks like they might be doing a little bit more of that here. Well, so I'm curious.
For me, like, I didn't know what a Darksaber was.
Yeah, I really don't. I couldn't even explain to you what it is. I just know of them because there was a book called Darksaber, and I've seen fans start to post that book cover.
Yeah, for me, though, I just watched that visual, mm-hmm. and I was like, that's a very striking visual. It yeah. looks ominous. It makes me intrigued for what's going to come in season two, as yeah. this character is obviously going to be pursuing Baby Yoda and Mandalorian
yeah.
going forward. So, I don't know. I'm sold on a season two going into The Mandalorian, and we'll continue on with the Mandalorian report.
Me too. And I mean, I love the, like, send off of the IG-1 character, yeah, the bounty hunter robot.
What a great emotional sequence there.
Yeah, you say emotional. I felt more emotion for that robot than I did about anything that happened in, you know, the new Star Wars movie.
Well, that's just that you were able to give your thoughts on the new yeah. Star Wars movie, and I had not seen it at that point. I had prioritized seeing Cats with you.
Yeah.
So I got out of it, and I think what you said in the previous podcast episode is that you sat there feeling frustrated a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm not coming in, I'm coming in more of as a kind of a general movie going audience member. Like I don't have like this big, long, you know, connection to the Star Wars universe. I've seen all the movies multiple times, but mm-hmm. for this, I felt frustrated in just from a basic storytelling, dramatic perspective in that they were just introducing elements that were, well, I just said plot point, plot point, plot point
yeah.
when that's what the Mandalorian was avoiding. And this
right,
is
yeah.
what Star
like,
Wars
Mandalorian is
from.
More like broad stroke storytelling, which is what Star Wars has always been really good at.
But when you get into like super like complicated and complex, you were talking about how we understood everything going on in A Mirror Darkly. But
yeah.
like a lot of this, like I'm just like, what, there's a Sith compass and a Sith dagger? And if you hold the dagger in a certain way, when
yeah.
the destroyed That's I'm just like, why should I care about any of the? It just feels as if like there's some sort of decoder ring in the bottom of a box of Cracker Jacks that I should be pulling out and handing it to Rey, and she can figure out all these like weird, silly mysteries that are going on, as opposed to like focusing on the characters that we've been following for
mm-hmm.
you know all these years. And that's what the frustrating thing was, is they could have done like a much smaller scale story with a lot of extravagant set pieces, but focus in on the main characters and then really justify their journeys and what we've been following. Instead, it's just kind of too reliant on like, okay, I think in A Mirror Darkly, great fan service.
Yeah.
Rise of Skywalker, I thought it was just a lot of cringeworthy fan service. Some good stuff, but
yeah.
a lot of stuff like it's...
I was happy to see Wedge. You know, there's little bits here and there.
I like that. But ultimately, yeah. I just found it like a... it wasn't an unpleasant
no.
movie, but it was just like an unsatisfying movie
yeah.
when I walked out of there. And like I'm far more interested in what The Mandalorian is going to deliver. New and interesting things, as opposed to just retreating on all the stuff that we've seen before, but just in a different shell.
Yeah. To me, you know, we've talked about In a Mirror Darkly. We've talked about The Mandalorian. What these two shows did really well is stick true to their characters from beginning to end. And to me, like, this Star Wars trilogy has failed its characters.
Yeah.
I think it's done okay with Rey. I think it's done fairly well with Kylo Ren, probably the best of any of the characters, probably with Kylo Ren.
Yeah, I agree.
And everyone else, it's kind of dropped the ball on.
What about those little nuns on the island that Luke was hanging out
How
with?
Did they not bring them back?
I know.
They
I
were
know.
So hilarious in the second one. Yeah. So, yeah, frustrating movie.
Yeah.
But it's one you can tell people are going to talk about for a long time. Which is not really what you want with like a mediocre movie.
talking about it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we're getting full throttle ready for Star Trek Picard. We have the short trek coming up next week, so we will be reviewing that. And also, just be prepared. We'll probably have our podcast out a little bit later than our video, so go to YouTube and you can find our video, our instant response to that right there, and that'll be fun. And Cam, we've been mapping out our calendar for the podcast in the coming months. It's going to be kind of a packed sort of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I think just means all that much, great content to deliver to folks. So keep tuning in.
I'm always excited going into a new Star Trek season because like anything could happen. The possibilities are endless.
Cam, I don't want to spoil anything, but I hear Baby Yoda is making an appearance in Star Trek Picard.
Yeah, as long as Palpatine's not back.
Okay,
so you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in vexed by Archer's hair, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P. P as in Picard Patine. O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.